The Guardian.
Hello, it's the Guardian Film Show, making hay in the dog days of summer. There are no holidays for the movies keep on coming. They're kicking ass on city streets, they're foiling vice rings in 70s Stockholm, and they're going undercover on the Tex-Mex border. And when they do board a plane and take to the air, it's actually only in the service of our entertainment, allegedly. Taking wing on this week's show, a humble crop duster dreams of aerial glory in the Disney cartoon Planes. Sweden's squeaky clean image takes a battering in the fact-based conspiracy thriller Call Girl. And Denzel Washington and Mark Wahlberg are locking antlers and blowing stuff up with the action romp Two Guns. We kick off though with Kick-Ass 2, in which Aaron Taylor-Johnson and Chloe Grace Moretz are back as the home-cooked superheroes, out to clean up the big bad city and perhaps overturn a few genre conventions along the way. We sent the Guardian's Ben Child down to meet Chloe Grace Moretz.
They may wear costumes, but it isn't Halloween. They're real-life superheroes.
It's anti-comic book. I mean, you know, it's about just normal kids dressing up in wetsuits and going out and fighting crime. I mean, it's incredibly accessible. You could see, you know, tomorrow on the BBC or like CNN, just seeing someone, you're seeing, you know, a whole group of superheroes walking on the streets. Ready to go again?
What do you want me to do?
Hit me.
You're a 15-year-old girl. Oh. What the hell?
Act like a bitch, get slapped like a bitch.
Oh, God.
Is there sort of a parallel between you and the character in the sense that you've also grown up in quite an adult arena?
Yeah, in a way. I mean, yeah. I mean, I think both of us are kind of put off by the idea of, like, high school and kind of confused around tons of teenagers and stuff because we have grown up in very adult lifestyles, yeah.
Hey, man.
Hey, Marcus, what's up?
I see you answered your phone. That means you're not in school.
I was, but I wasn't feeling so good, and so the nurse decided to send me home.
Poor thing. Well, I'm almost home. I'll make you some soup, and we can watch Jeopardy.
All right, I'll see you soon, okay?
All right.
Is it nice not to have so much attention on the kind of the foul mouth and all the rest of it?
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice to have less of the controversy aspect and more of actually being able to do the character.
Uh-huh.
You know, it makes it a bit more interesting for me because it's less people asking me everything about controversy and asking me more about who the character is.
And all the controversy seemed to be on sort of the Jim Carrey decision this time.
Yeah, he got the heat and I didn't have to answer all the controversial questions.
Sure, right.
Makes it easy for me, right?
I am gonna make Kick-Ass pay for what he did to my dad.
Yo, Kick-Ass!
I'm building an evil army.
Who is this guy?
He's claiming to be the world's first real supervillain.
I'm joined now by the Guardian's Henry Barnes and Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw. Henry, Kick-Ass 1 came out as a kind of left-field, purely pleasurable success, didn't it? Does the lightning strike twice?
For me, it didn't really. I really like Kick-Ass 1 because it sort of tackled the pomposity of a lot of superhero films. And since then, that film came out 4 years ago, since then we've had things like Man of Steel and the Avengers movie, which to some degree or another have that same like self-important sense, I guess, and very like very full of honour and justice and about these heroes.
So the demolition job didn't work?
It didn't really, no. I mean, like, because this film's come back around now and it's trying to do the same scruffy, violent, funny thing that the first film did, but to me it's just not funny enough to carry it. And fatally, there's a point where Kick-Ass says, this isn't a comic book, this is real life. And then we're supposed to believe afterwards that the fight scenes that they're in where there's blood spraying everywhere and it's incredibly gratuitous don't mean anything anymore. And as soon as you're told and pulled out of the fantasy that this isn't just comic book violence, then you suddenly think, well, actually, you know, this is a bit gratuitous and grotesque in its own sense as well. So it didn't really have that same lighthearted touch. And it didn't have the same puerile sense of humour that the first one did. And that's why the first one worked for me and this one doesn't.
Would you agree with that? It's a case of loyalties, isn't it? The first film was kind of outside the tent pissing in,
yeah.
And this has kind of almost been brought on side a bit.
Yeah, I thought that it wasn't really upending the genre now. It was slightly
kind of paying homage to the genre, really, especially Spider-Man. There's lots of, you know, giving your word to your dad that you would do something and then being forced not to do it over and over again, real Spider-Man stuff. I love the first Kick-Ass movie. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. And it's still got a lot of that scrappiness, and it still looks good compared to the pompous sort of Man of Steel.
I kind of like the fight scenes. They're proper kind of brawls, aren't they? They're kind of messy.
She's very good. Chloe Moretz is very, very good indeed. Mm. And her fight stuff, her martial arts stuff, body double though it may be, it's still very good. It looks very, very strong indeed. And her storyline of having to abandon her superhero strength to be a pathetic teenage girl, I think it's really interesting. Watching boy bands. I thought that was great stuff, that sort of teen movie Clueless stuff they went to. It was really good. It was part of what made the first film so good. Mm. But all this stuff about loads and loads of new superheroes, a big kind of crew of villains versus a crew of heroes, pretty has-been stuff, I think. And Jim Carrey went for nothing, really. He had very little to do. His part as Colonel Stars and Stripes, kind of underwritten and uninteresting. So Chloe Moretz keeps it afloat, in my view. She's still really good, really good. And he kind of has that sass that the first movie has, but it's sort of losing it, I think.
What was the deal with Jim Carrey? He signed up for this film and then had buyer's remorse and decided he didn't like it.
He came out on Twitter saying, I think shortly after they finished filming, saying, I'm not supporting this film because of Sandy Hook and gun violence, and I can't be tied to a film like this.
And yet he made Ace Ventura 2.
Great film. But actually, he's not, in terms of gun violence, there isn't an awful lot of gunplay in this film, whether they toned that down because of sensibilities around Sandy Hook, maybe. He's not incredibly violent in this film. I thought he was actually quite a good fit for the part, and he walks that line between the comedy element of the film, which there wasn't enough of for me, and then the heavy drama that director Jeff Wadlow tries to put into it as well. Jim Carrey is the kind of actor who can walk in both of those genres and feel just about right with a ridiculous character like Colonel Stars and Stripes. So it is kind of strange for him to kind of come out and trash and burn the film after he's been in it.
It's very strange. You needed a kind of older man presence in the ranks of the superheroes, and the last time, of course, that was brilliantly Nick Cage.
He was great.
Absolutely brilliant, doing that kind of Bruce Wayne voice. But really, I suppose they wanted Jim Carrey to be like that, to give us some kind of grounding and anchoring to all these kids. And maybe he just did a lot of scenes and they had to cut them or something, I don't know. But he really wasn't in the film very much, to be honest. And when he was in the film, he wasn't really delivering that Jim Carrey kind of live wire stuff that we were hoping for, not at all.
But Nick Cage's character in the first one, I think Nick Cage understood the ridiculousness of the situation.
Yeah.
And in this one, you have lots of shots of the empty pseudo Batman suit that he used to wear, and you just think that's an analogy.
And a cheesy photo of him on the wall.
Yeah. Exactly, but that's an analogy for the film, or a visual metaphor for the film, because you think you're
Where
really missing a Nick Cage.
But basically, the film had a really good story of Kick-Ass and Hit-Girl's kind of quasi-sibling relationship. It wasn't really a romantic relationship, quasi-sibling relationship triangulated by Nick Cage at the top. Now we don't have anything like that at all. We just have a sort of miscellaneous selection of new heroes and new villains, some of whom are quite funny. And really, there's this one, I think, teen girl storyline which really makes sense dramatically, but not much else.
My daddy made me promise I'd never stop defending this city. I'm prepared for anything.
We gotta make this right.
It's killing me.
There's no room for punks in suits. Just real heroes. Who can really kick ass.
That's Kick-Ass 2 hopping towards the mainstream. Now, let's say you've got Denzel Washington in one corner, Mark Wahlberg in the other, and the two men are on collision course. Then woo mama, take cover. It's not one gun, it's two.
Everybody sit down on the floor.
What's your figure?
40 million.
But I got bad news for you.
Is that a badge in your hand?
DEA.
The Icelandic director Baltasar Kormákur jets into America to commandeer this tale of two deep cover lawmen on the front line of the drugs war. When Washington and Wahlberg aren't bickering and bantering, they're shooting crooks and torching cars and generally breaking the rules to get results.
We gotta figure out whose money that was.
Well, like we're working together?
No, not like we're working.
Yeah!
No, like we're working in the same vicinity.
Together.
In the same area code.
Together.
ripped off the CIA.
Where's the money?
It ain't down there, I can guarantee you that.
Peter, if you liked Bad Boys and Bad Boys 2, you're going to kind of like this.
You're going to more or less feel indifferent in the same way. I don't know. It's almost like A-listers Westworld, really. Denzel and Mark, we were seeing the Denzel bot and the Mark Wahlberg bot kind of go through the motions in exactly the way you'd expect. I mean, it really was eerie. It's as if they had replicated themselves and were in Malibu while they were shooting, doing something else. They were going through the motions, really. Lots of spurious explosions, lots of gunfights. Borderline offensive use of one single female character played by Paula Patton, who really had nothing. She loves dancing around in her underwear, and that's all she gets to do.
Nothing to do, nothing to wear.
Certainly doesn't take any part in any action in any way. It is the most offensive thing, really. There's a few funny things in it, I suppose.
They're kind of good. Even going through the motions, there's a professionalism.
Yes, that's true. I have a kind of respect for the zen of Mark Wahlberg, particularly, who is the most unactory actor of anyone I think I've ever seen. He's just doing what he does. And Denzel is a class turn and always brings something to the party. But I don't know, yeah. I mean, if it was Michael Bay doing it, it would have been even worse. But Baltazar Komulkar, this guy who worked with Mark Wahlberg on
Contraband,
that's right. He's such a safe pair of hands.
He's a kind of interesting director over in Iceland. He did a great film called Jar City.
Yes, exactly. Reykjavik 101. It was interesting. And he's an actor as well.
Yeah. And yet, what's the problem? He's just become a Hollywood hack.
He had this entree into Hollywood through the Contraband remake of Reykjavik Rotterdam.
Yeah.
He acted in that. And then Mark Wahlberg took it over as a property, and that gave, as I understand it, Komulkar his big break in Hollywood. And then he put all his, as it were, authorial identity to one side and became a kind of technical director and took what must have been presumably a nice paycheck for doing it. And good luck to him. You know, that was his career break in Hollywood. Mm. But as far as the rest of us in the auditorium are concerned, well, he's just another hack, really, which is a shame because, of course, he didn't start out that way.
Drop the gun, Bobby. Give me the keys. Nice and easy.
Can't do that.
Why not?
Well, I got them first. I got dibs.
I got a .44. I'm taking Poppy. Give me the keys.
You want them? Come get them. I see the wheels turning. You're thinking, a little blindfold. Maybe use your teeth.
That's not what I'm thinking. You know what I'm thinking?
What? Oh, shit, man.
How's that?
That was uncalled for. You know, I liked you better when you were, I know a guy, Bobby. I mean, that Bobby was a good guy.
Well, I liked you better when you were winking at waitresses and shooting the heads off of chickens. Give me the keys. Give me the keys.
Shit! You saw that move coming?
That's correct. Give me the keys.
Damn, you're good.
Mark Wahlberg and Denzel Washington blowing stuff up and making a scene in Two Guns. We now move back in time to mid-70s Sweden. This was an era of free love, free healthcare, and perfect freedom of opportunity. And yet, wouldn't you know it, there was trouble here as well.
Var ska vi någonstans?
Lyssna noga på mamma nu. Vårdat språk. Inga svordomar. Inga frågor.
Ska välja en riktigt snygg tjej till din kollega.
Cool Girl is a true crime's tale from the underbelly, an account of a Swedish vice ring that plays out under a fog of tobacco smoke. The girls from the juvenile home are strong-armed away to cheesy house parties and ritzy dinners. Chances are, they are all bound for the minister's bed.
Henry, I know that you weren't alive in the 1970s, but they really were that yellow.
It's all the indoor smoking, I think.
This film really grew on me. I started out and it took a good 45 minutes for me to realise that they were Cool Girls for a start, because the director doesn't tell you that explicitly for that long. And then it grows and grows and grows. And some would say that it was boring and tedious, but I think it was just a kind of masterful slow pace, and it took us to a really interesting drama. It doesn't really have a traditional story.
No, arc. You're dealing with a vice ring here, it's almost like a kind of slice of life drama until the last 40 minutes.
But you see it backwards, because you don't really see the cops working on the so-called case. Mm. You see it all from the victim's point of view. So the cop comes in kind of almost tangentially as a character towards the end of the movie, which is a very strange way to, form a cop thriller. but really worked for me, I thought. I thought Penilla August, who plays the Madame of the House, is stunning in this. Really great, kind of sinister, overbearing
that
matriarch.
That smile that she has all the time is just chilling.
And someone who's obviously seen horrendous things during her life and has just decided to lock it all out and put that all on these young charges that she's taken on. So really great.
Peter, did that sort of slow burn effect work for you?
Sort of. I have to say I was less enthralled than Henry in a way. I thought it was very well made. The director of photography, Heta van Hooyden, I think worked on Tinker Tailor and had that brilliant kind of Instagram effect, 70s Instagram look, which had and had some stunning scenes in it, some stunning images. It is based on a real life story though. And in a way, the journalist in me, as opposed to the critic in me, kept thinking, hang on, look, if this is based on a real life story, then stop being so coy. You know, make a documentary about it. If you've got something to say, really something important to say about the Swedish governing classes, then I think you should say it. Because to be honest, there was something a bit familiar about the conspiracy trope.
It would be a different film though, wouldn't it? I mean, it's also, it's looking at the lives of these two girls from a juvenile home, and they're well played. I mean, Sophie Karamir as Iris, the main one, is a terrific performance from her.
Yeah, I think they're both great. I think you're right. I think there might be an argument to say the director's consciously put aside the real world politics of it to look more at the human drama behind it, which is a valid decision, I think, you know, and does make for an interesting film in itself. Another thing about the style of it, I think the music in this is fantastic, chiefly because he uses very obscure, like, 70s
disco
track. Disco, but uses it so cleverly, like, when you even get to the things you recognise, like ABBA, he'll just suddenly chop out. So you're left with this real feeling of dislocation, that the music set you in this mood of, oh, you're having a party, and then the party ends quite harshly as they cut the sound out. And that's a really nice way of saying that, you know, this is fun, but this is paid for fun, and it's completely false and utterly bleak, really.
And what's, I think, very interesting about it is it's very, very sceptical about the permissive sexual revolution in Sweden. I mean, it reminded me in a way of that Lukas Moodysson film Together, which has a much more affectionate view. Whereas what Marsimen, the director, is here saying this is all bullshit.
This is a mask.
This is a bullshit. Yeah. This is just another opportunity for male sexual plunder.
Yeah.
This is just the same old reactionary sexual politics that we had before. Mm. And I think that's a very interesting thing to say coming from Sweden.
Du är en väldigt speciell flicka. Du ska bara ha det bästa. Ingen jävla mellantjafs.
Det enda du ska göra är att hålla käften.
Cool Girl showing us the sordid truth behind Scandinavia. But we shall end on a literal high with Planes, which tells the story of little Dusty, who wants to be so much more than just a crop duster. Specifically, he wants to win a round-the-world race, which is, you know, just ridiculous because he's obviously a loser and he's going down in flames. Anyway, I'm prejudging. Let's see what really happens. Here's Henry Barnes talking to two of the film's cast members, Terry Hatcher and John Cleese.
Plane. Landscaping was yesterday, man. Right. Get off the runway. We're racing here.
Hey.
Second call for Strut Jetstream.
No.
Looking for...
I'm Strut Jetstream.
You're Strut Jetstream?
Yep.
A crop duster? Man, what's going on here? Is everybody getting to fly today? Man, your mama must have had high hopes for you. Now, you know you're built for speed, not speed.
Disney films, to me, the popularity of them seems to be that there's very little jeopardy there, or it's always going to be a happy ending. And obviously that's a nice message for younger kids, but I was wondering if it's that healthy to teach kids all the time that life is always going to offer you success.
Well, you're heavy. But what I think that Disney actually does really well is infuse some very common human struggles, human insecurities, and conquering that stuff. And I think that's what makes their movies so long-lasting and so relatable.
I was once told that it was very important for kids' healthy development that they should grow up believing the world to be a better place than it actually is. And that is very interesting. And I think it's probably true. I think it is better to teach kids to be fundamentally trusting than to be fundamentally mistrusting. But then, of course, you then have to learn that you can trust an awful lot of people at your own risk.
In this movie, I would concentrate more on the idea that here's somebody that's going to face some pretty big fears to try to reach a goal that they really want. And, you know, that doesn't just take one person, it takes a community, you know, it takes risk. And yes, they, you know, they do reach the goal and there is the happy ending at the end. But I think in a way, well, I don't want to say it, but I mean, I think it wouldn't matter if he won or didn't win. Like that's, so I'm saying I don't know that the end is so, because I think the bigger thing is that he faces his fears and he conquers them and he goes for it and he gets so much out of that experience.
Later on, it's very important that they get information that allows them to realize what the reality is about the state of the world. And as I've got older, I have become more and more disillusioned about the way the world works.
Dusty, you're not built to race. You're built to dust crops. Do you know what will happen if you push it too far? Wing flutter, turbine failure.
Turbine failure?
Oh no, I'm going down. Why didn't I listen to Dottie?
Yeah, why don't you listen to
She's
Dottie?
She's the smartest mechanic in the world. Oh my gosh.
What?
The orphanage. Kids, fly out of the orphanage. Kaboom!
The kids.
Peter, were you cheering Dusty on all the way?
I sort of was. I was in an audience full of kids, actually, as critics very rarely are when they see this kind of film. And perhaps we should always go and see this sort of thing in an audience of kids so that you at least know what it's going to do to the target audience. And the target audience were entertained. I think it is very cheeky because it is simply a retread of Cars in the most outrageous way. I mean, it's not a sequel. Cars 2, however kind of annoying that was, did try to be a sequel in the sense that it was some sort of progression. Now, of course, Planes is at least notionally about a completely different set of characters, so it doesn't have to be a progression. But really, it is just Cars. It's just Cars with wings, as the admin said, with wings. Really, that's it. It's got all the old ingredients. It is a lovable underdog plane. It's got a grumpy oldster who agrees to mentor the plane. You sort of have to buy into the idea of a racing plane on a round-the-world plane race. What? What are you talking about? And lots of lovable international stereotypes and archetypes. One, of course, is our very own John Cleese, who does a fairly Route One sort of stiff upper lip British chap.
We've got the Spanish.
The Spanish guy whisking his cape and everything. I mean, it's pretty kind of moderate, really. And yes, it kind of does its job in a way, I have to say. It does sort of flow along. It's kind of eerily smooth. It's not actually from the Pixar stable. It's from the new, as I understand it, Disney Toons stable. And maybe it doesn't have much of the grit that Pixar really might have brought to it. But it, I don't know, it does its job. It certainly does its job, a job of work for the family audience, yeah.
The bits I quite liked were there's a few moments of weird sort of darkness and peril in there where he crashes into the sea, and then there's the old flashback to the World War II bombing raid, which were kind of good, and the rest of it was cheap as chips, wasn't it?
Yeah, except the bit where he sinks to the bottom of the sea and then the rest of the film is him just meditating on his failure. I really enjoyed that bit.
That was good. Yeah. That went on for 4 hours, but it was still kind of beautiful.
God, it was beautiful.
Had stark beauty.
I was in tears by the end of it. I do think there is something that's like, I mean, it feels like every time we watch an animation now, maybe just a Disney animation, but we're always saying, well, it's not quite as good as the Pixar films of, you know, 10 years ago.
No,
but
it
really isn't. And maybe that is the disadvantage of setting that bar so high now that a kind of bog standard Disney movie, which this is, you know, has had a lot of money thrown at it with a fairly profile-y cast, not badly written, but ultimately pretty dull and pretty rote, is now a bad Disney / Pixar film.
You know. Yeah, I mean, we've only just realised that we've emerged from this golden age. Maybe we didn't appreciate it enough at the time.
Well, I think we did.
Well, I didn't think we thought of it as a golden age. I thought each and every film was a stunning individual piece of joy. But only afterwards, when I suddenly started watching, you know, Shrek the Third and thinking, hang on, has something happened now? You know, is it all over? Is the party over? And I think it is. You've got these movies like Despicable Me 2 and Monsters University, which are not bad. I mean, they're really not bad. And if it hadn't been for those great films, we might be thinking, wow, this is great. But now we think, oh my goodness, what's happened to the good old days? Where are the snows of yesteryear? And I'm afraid we've been spoiled.
He's the indoor racing champion of all Mexico.
Indoor racing?
And numero uno recording artist, telenovela star, and romance novelist.
Did you say El Chupacabra or El Cuckoo Cabra?
You make joke?
Very well.
You leave me no choice! I squeeze my cape at you!
Touchdown and taxiing, we've got our seatbelts unbuckled, and we're about to disembark. My thanks, as ever, to Henry Barnes and Peter Bradshaw. We're back on the same runway next week. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.